Today, in Luke chapter 2, about page 906 in your pew Bibles, we're going to begin a study that's going to continue on for a few months. We're going to look at the life of Jesus Christ. Hebrews 12, verse 2, says that we are to look to Jesus, who is the author and the finisher of our faith. Sometimes in both marital counseling and premarital counseling, when we especially talk about the role of the husband, I say, men, in order for you to truly love your wives to be, or if they're already married, your wives, like Christ loved the church, you need to go back and do a rather in-depth study on Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. Now, again, we understand the church did not come to realization, Pentecost in Acts chapter 2 and Christ's ascension and all of that. But we can look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and see, how did Christ love people? What did He do? What did He not do? What did He say? What did He not say? So we're going to begin this study as we look to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, going through the Gospels and seeing what He said and what He did and what He didn't do. Hopefully, as a result of learning what Jesus did, we will then pattern our lives by it. We are to be Christians. We're to be Christ-like ones. So therefore, we need to get a good understanding of the life of Christ, as recorded for us in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and then adjust our lives accordingly. And I know sometimes that's difficult. Believe me, to contort our bodies sometimes is really tough. You know, and as we get a little older, sometimes to contort our bodies is sometimes a little more difficult. But regardless, we must do it. And we don't take the Bible and conform it to us. We take our lives and we conform it to the Bible. So we're going to do a lot of contorting here in the weeks and months to come as we look at the life of Christ and then adjust our lives accordingly. As I mentioned, this is the only account of Christ's life for 30 years. We've got His birth earlier in Luke 2, and that's why we didn't read the whole thing. There's not much we can learn from Christ as an infant other than He was there doing infant things, I guess. But then we go 12 years, and then we've got this account of the parents going to the Passover to Jerusalem. And we've got this dialogue going on there with the religious leaders. And then He says and does something that's absolutely mind-boggling to His parents. And then with silence. Then kind of like the story just goes on mute for another 18 years. And then when He begins His public ministry, we come to the scene with, what's the next event there in Jesus' ministry? Yeah, baptism with John the Baptist. And there's some profound things that we have got. Well, I can't give it away. But anyway, come back in a week or two and we'll look at some really powerful principles of Christ's baptism. And what is that all about? Being baptized by a human being and baptizing and just all what was going on there. I think there's some real things we can learn. So let's jump into this real quick, and I just want to give you the backdrop, and I'll give you the interaction with the religious leaders, and that's probably all we'll get to today. In verse 41, we see that His parents are law-abiding citizens. Now, you don't get that explicitly from that, but if you go back to chapter 1, verse 22, when the days of her purification according to the law of Moses were completed, she's following the law. In verse 23, they're presenting Him to the Lord just because it goes way back to the Passover. The firstborn belongs to God. Remember way back in Exodus? That's why they had to put the blood on the sides of the door and the top of the door, because the angel of death would come by and kill the firstborn. And the firstborn belongs to God, as according to the law of Moses there in verse 23. As we go on to verse 24, they brought the sacrifice according to the law, which was the pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. And then in verse 39, so they had performed all the things according to the law of the Lord. They returned to Galilee and their own city, Nazareth. And every year they were to go up to the Passover to Jerusalem to offer their offerings. And this is what they are doing. Now, at age 12, now he's not age 13 yet, and at age 13 is when the bar mitzvah comes, when they become the sons of the commandment, when they become the realization of who they were, the bar mitzvah, the yoke of the law, the son of commandment. That's not till a year later. So he's still 12. He's a little young, but he's getting the full experience of what's going on here. And what's going on here is profound. We find that at this time, there's people from all over the dispersion. There's people probably from Egypt going up to Jerusalem. There's people from Asia Minor going down. I mean, these are one of the days where they're supposed to go to the temple and offer their sacrifices. And the place is jammed, packed full. And the amount of slaughter and the amount of animals that are being sacrificed are probably in the hundreds of thousands. And I think that as we also would not think, but I know from his answer there in verse 49, at this particular age, and we can argue till the cows come home, using an agricultural expression of speech, when exactly he realized when he was God. But we know for a fact at age 12 when he says, "What are you doing looking for me? Don't you know I must be about my father, not Joseph, but I must be about my father's business." So we know for sure at age 12 there was a full realization of all that was going on and who he was. So with this full realization, when he's seeing these animals slaughtered by the scores and the blood and just the burden of sin that's on the people and just the hardship of coming to the temple and to sacrifice the animals and just the heavy oppression of the people, I'm sure his heart was just broken. Especially when he again realizes who he is, that it's not going to be too many more years down the road when he is going to become the Passover lamb. When, as it was told, "Behold, the Lamb of God, which takes away the sins of the world." And just as this young man, I suppose, just the sensory overload would have just been immense. Just the blood, just the smell of the blood and all the carcasses and the burning and just all the stuff that goes on with killing of all these animals, the sacrificing and all the people and just the throng and just the pushing and just all the stuff that goes on for one little temple in comparison to the thousands of people. But then also there's the realization that that's him. He's seeing a foreshadow of what's going to happen to him too long. And as all these animals are being the Passover lamb, and he's really realizing that it's going to be his blood that's going to have to take upon the weight of all these people. It's interesting that while Jesus was killed by the religious leaders, he still loved the law. I remember in Matthew 5:17, he says, "Do not think I've come to destroy the law of the prophets." He didn't come to destroy it. He came to fulfill it. So here again, what we got going on here, and I'll do this rather quickly. In verses 43 and 44, we have assuming parents. We have assuming parents because we know that Jesus Christ was without sin. He didn't sin as a toddler. He didn't sin as an adolescent. He didn't sin in his preteen years. So this was not Jesus. You know, here, let's put it this way, and I'll use my son as an example. I don't know if I was with a group of people and we would just leave for 3 days going home without trying to figure out where is Eric. Because Eric was just always there. You know, they never have to wonder where Eric is and what he's doing, because he's just always there. Now, some could argue, because it was true when the procession moved, usually the children went first because they kind of set the pace because there weren't riding or driving at that time. They're probably walking. So the kids kind of set the pace, and then you have the women, and then you have the men following. Okay? So it could be that with Mary and Joseph being separated, they also then assumed not so much that he wasn't up to trouble, that he was going along, but it could be like sometimes we've even had here at Oxford Valley Chapel, and some of you younger ones can attest you got left. Because mom thought you were dad, and dad thought you were with mom, and dad drove away, and mom drove away, and you're sitting here. So I don't know if some of you are still here, but I've called a couple parents and said, "Hey, I don't want them either, but you got to come get them. They're your kids. You got to come." Well, it depends upon if it's 6 months into the year so we could get them a tax deduction or not. But in any way, I don't want them either, so one of you got to come back and get them. But the point is that They didn't give too much thought in their leaving that where is Jesus? What is he up to? Because he was the Son of God who never sinned. Okay? Then, what happened though after 43 and 46 is that one day out, okay, they travel one day out, and when they get one day out, as supper is being cooked and tents are being set up and everything's getting ready, someone's starting to say, hey, where's Jesus? And there's some dialogue going back and forth, and they find out that he is not there. So because of the highwaymen, and you know, the good Samaritan and the one who was taken by thieves and beaten and left for dead, they're not going to be traveling at night. And they wait till the morning. They travel one day back there. And then there's some nighttime going on. And then the third day, and look at what it says there. It says, as you read down there in verse 46, so it was that after 3 days, so probably the third day, now they're still in Jerusalem, and Alfred Edersheim is saying that probably within the temple proper, you could fit no less than 210,000 people. Okay, so we're talking a big populace. And again, they probably were dressing pretty similar to the same, you know, we all have in our minds that, you know, Jewish garb of the robes and stuff like that. So it's not like we got punk rockers and piercings and tattoos and different colored folks. You know, they're all probably Jewish. They're all pretty much looking about the same. They're all dressed pretty much the same. And there are thousands of people. All right, so here's kind of a question that we don't have a lot of time to chase down, all kinds of speculations, but where would you look first? Where's Jesus? I mean, we've got the whole city here. Where would you look? Where would you go to first? Well, unfortunately, after looking for the better part of the day, they find him at the temple. And they find him there sitting with the authority there. Sitting with authority. And they begin to talk to him just a little bit. And in verse 46 to 48, they come upon this traditional teaching scene of sitting down, and there's dialogue going back. The teachers are seated, and in the midst of the teachers, and again, probably the greatest minds were there. They traveled all over. And they've all gathered together, and they're now going to debate and fine tune the finer parts of the law, and what did Moses mean here, and what did Moses mean there, and all the academia was just going at it. And Jesus is sitting right there in the middle of all of that. It'd be kind of like going to your master's or your doctoral dissertation where you have to give your oral defense. But instead of just having the scholars of your school there, you've got the scholars of Christendom there. And they're just going to, well, I don't know if they're really interrogating Christ, because Christ is the one discussing and asking them questions. But the point is that he's in the middle of it. Now, again, there's a couple of things here that really drive home verse 49. And it's not so much stated because he's not eaten for 3 days. Or it doesn't say anything about that. Where did he eat? Where did he sleep? What did he do at nighttime? But none of that is important. And the reason is none of that is important because of what he says there in verse 49. Now for you and I have gone on an occasional day fast. And occasionally I do like the praying and fasting. And I can tell you, I've never gone 3 days. Some of you have fasted chocolate or gave up chocolate. Some of you give up coffee or whatever. I can't understand coffee for the life of me. That is the millennial brew in heaven, by the way. So you might as well just start drinking it anyway. But the point is that where did he sleep? I mean, you got a lot of people there. We get a little idea of what this was earlier. When there is no room at the inn, you know, back, you know, 8-12 years earlier, this place is mobbed. So where is he? What is he doing? But the point of the whole passage is that has no bearing about it because he's about his father's business. And that's what's important. It doesn't matter where he ate. Doesn't matter if he ate at all. Doesn't matter where he slept or if he slept at all. What is important was that he was about his father's business. So here he is. Right here in verses 47, 48, and a little bit of 49, he's right there in the midst of academia, right in the midst of the who's of the brain world of the day. But he's not there as a teacher. He's there of a student. He's sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking questions. He's the listener. He's not the teacher. And again, as we know from verse 49, there is a recognition now of who he is and his mission. And this is not your average 12-year-old lad, obviously. And everyone, as verse 47 says, so here's this dialogue going on with Jesus, are amazed. This guy, as we would often use with some teenagers and sometimes with kids, we'd say, man, you are wise beyond your years. You are getting this whole idea. You're getting a biblical worldview. You're wise beyond your years. And I can imagine that's what they were saying to this 12-year-old lad. Wow! He's got it. Man, I mean, listen to him. He's got a handle on it. He's putting it all together. Man, he's putting pieces together. These questions that he's asking, they are insightful. He's got a handle. He knows where he's going with this. It was remarkable. Now, and this is where we'll pause here for today, is he subjecting himself to these religious leaders? Again, verse 46. They find him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. The religious community, 18 years later, what is the religious community? What are these teachers trying to do to Jesus? Well, actually, a little more than 18 plus 3. So 21 years later, so what are these guys trying to do to Jesus? Kill him. They were trying to subvert him. They were trying to do everything they could to derail his mission. They finally were able to get Judas, because Judas was kind of a willing participant of this, and they got Judas to betray him. They wanted this guy dead. There's more than one time, and those of you that are reading through the Bible in the year, you've probably gotten through Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. There's more than one time when they tried to kill him, but God just kind of went through the middle of them, where it wasn't his time yet. Now, Jesus Christ, as he's realizing who he is, he's got an amount of deity there with him, and I'm, Scogan speculation, I'm sure he knows full well that these guys, 18 plus leaders, yeah, that guy right there is going to be the one who's going to try to have me killed. And that one there is going to go along with it. And that one's going to make the motion, and that one's going to second it. And all of these are going to vote in favor of it. And that guy's going to be talking to Judas. And that guy there is going to bring me before Pilate. And what did he do to them? Did he, man, lambast them? Did he embarrass them? Did he humiliate them? Did he mock them? Did he give them a piece of his mind? Did he get it off his chest? He submitted himself to the authority there. He submitted himself to bad and evil authority. He was in subjection to the religious establishment. The religious establishment that he would say that you were of your father, the devil. He would say that they are stiff-necked, hard-hearted, and yet at this time, now later on in his life, he now then is making some statements, and he is now teaching the teachers. But at this point in his life, he willingly, of his own volition, is submitting to authority that is bad. And it's evil, and not that the law of Moses was evil, but the way that they were manipulating and exploiting the people was evil. So here, let me ask you a question. And let's get down to some real nuts and bolts as we close here. What would be your response if the United States of America, somehow some goofy laws were passed, and it was decided that we are now going to hunt down and kill Christians? What would we do to that bad, evil authority? Well, what was Christ teaching on the tyranny of Rome? Do we have Jesus Christ gathering his disciples yelling, "To arms! To arms!" What about Christ? How did he respond to the religious and political authority when he was captured, when he went through these monkey trials? And then when they passed the death sentence upon him, How did he respond to that? He says, oh, by the way, I want you to know that you're only doing this because I'm allowing you. If I wanted to, I could call more angels than you could handle. And they would flatten you and I'd be out of here. But there's that idea of submitting to authority. What about the Apostle Paul? With the beatings and the imprisonment and all the hardships that he'd go through. Did the Apostle Paul, in any of his epistles, do we read, two arms, let's kill them? No. Submitting to authority. Well, why is that? Well, Romans 13 gives us probably the best passage of that. Where does any authority come from according to Romans 13? God. You think that the tyranny of Rome was outside the will of God? You think that if America should ever, for whatever reason, make it fair, open season on Christians, that's outside of the will of God? And God's like, oh, no, I don't know what to do. You submit to authority. Besides, as believers, can you threaten me with heaven? No. No, not at all. Now, the process of dying, I don't necessarily look forward to. But death? Death would be my very best friend, because to be absent from body, which because we may have a death here in just a minute, in a minute. If I don't get done in time, there may be a stoning. But as you know, Joe Powell is not doing very well. And we oftentimes, and let me just indulge me for just a minute. As believers, do we ever die? No. We never die. Now, our body dies. But this is something that's important for us to communicate to people who are facing the shadow of death. The body dies, but Joe Powell will never die. Because to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. For me to live is Christ, and to die is to gain. So, there is that spiritual being, that Dan Scogan or the Joe or whoever, that will never die. We will change in existence from here on earth to either heaven or hell, but the spirit never dies. So when we talk about death, it's kind of understood, but it needs to be understood that we're just talking about the body. We have had people die this year. We have one who's probably dying this year. We may have other people who die this year, but it's only their bodies. They will never die. They will live for forever. So back to the religious and to the bad authority that we may be involved in. The government wants to kill me, kill my body, go for it. Because I get to go be that much quicker to Jesus Christ. So here, let's get right down to some real nuts and bolts. What about young people? The authority at school. What about you guys at work? The authority at work. I don't care if it's stupid. I don't care if it's seeped with nepotism. It's authority. And you need to obey it. What about our township? We have obeyed our authority. And it's taken us years, and to my knowledge, we still have not gotten the official letter from the township solicitor saying the building can go forward. They just like to rack some more money out of us. I think that is all it is. But it's to be done. Everybody approved it. We just haven't done it. But we're not building the building without it. We will wait. We will abide by the authority of the township. The national authority. Doesn't matter. If it's wrong, doesn't matter. Because again, who determines what's wrong? Depends upon what side of that equation you're on. But you and I, we need to look to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith regarding to authority. And you will see here in this passage, we'll develop it next week, he submitted himself to the religious authority. He submitted himself to some very emotional, fickle human authority. God, the one who created man and woman, is now submitting himself to a mom and dad who are going to be fickle. And as you read there in the bottom of verse 51 and 52, there's no whining, no complaining, no kicking of the dirt. Oh, mom, do we gotta? He did it. He submitted himself to them. And then we see him submitting himself one more to another authority, and that is of God the Father. So when we leave here next week, I just want to again impose to you, as we look to Jesus, as Hebrews 12:2, who is the author and the finisher of our faith, we must be all about submitting to authority. Whether it's good, whether it's bad, whether we like it, whether we don't. whether it's parental authority, whether it's governmental authority, whether it's spiritual authority, you must be in submission to authority. Why did we have these verses here in Luke 2? Why did Jesus Christ, or God the Father, out of all 30 years of His early life, why did He pick this? In my mind, it's to show He is submitting to authority. This, by the way, is the God who says in Matthew, all authority is given in heaven and earth to me. And it is this God who is submitting Himself to authority. So I pray that you will take this, go home and think through that school authority, that work authority, that township ordinance that you really don't like. You mean I got to follow it? Well, you either go to the township and get a waiver, a variance, or yes, you do. The national authority. Well, I didn't vote for him, or I didn't vote for them. How come? We must obey the authority over us. There's that one little footnote, right? In Acts 5, we need to obey God rather than men. But until there's a contradiction or a conflict, we need to be obeying God. So again, I would just encourage you to look to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who is in submission to authority, even though they may be wrong and or hypocritical. Heads bowed, eyes are closed. As I was talking about authority, did I inadvertently step on your toes? I didn't plan it. But did the Holy Spirit point out anything in your life? Kids, maybe we'll touch on this. You know, just knock that attitude off. You don't need that attitude, kids. There's no reason for the attitude. I know that they're not perfect parents. I too am an imperfect parent. Knock the attitude off. Just quit with the attitude. Those of us at work, we know the employee handbook. We know the right way to do it. But then there's the other ways we can do it. And just by cutting a few corners, we can get done a little quicker. You know, violating a few procedures, we can get more of the paperwork done. Now, it's not exactly following protocol procedure, but, you know, everybody's doing it. The authority there, the structure and work. Are we obeying what we are being told to do? Government. I got 3 new stop signs there in Snowball Drive. Am I going to stop for those new stop signs? The speed limits, and the list goes on and on and on and go. Are we going to obey those in authority over us? Or will we become God?